The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
It is now time to get into justice. And Andisa, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Andisa, you are called this morning?
I do, actually. So this year started off so... I don't know what to say. I started off the year with the virus. So and it still had court. So from the very first day we had court, as a matter of fact, from the very first day we had a trial for manslaughter. So quite literally, every day since the year started, it has been pace. But I like it. I like it.
All right, cool. So this morning, Inside Justice, we revisiting some of these things on the fines. Now, when we talking fines, now for me, Andisa, I don't have a problem with traffic fines, you know.
Yeah.
You're doubling down on it, you know. I cool with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where I had the problem. You see that licensing division thing with your license coming in and you having to pay that $650?
Mm-hmm.
I may not have a problem with that either, but you can't tell me that persons trying to get to go online, and because you had to go online, you can't walk in license office. And those fees, you can't tell me that we're trying to log in to get a date. And we're not getting the date. The date is being pushed back past my expiration date of my license. And then you're penalizing me for it.
Yeah, because I pass Caroni to get to work every morning. And I remember when they announced that the fees were going to increase and persons would receive fees for certain things. There was so much traffic in Caroni that day because I guess everybody was flocking to licensing office to get things done. So, and there's still trucks lying straight down Caroni every morning. So I guess there will be a large influx of persons trying to ensure that they are in order. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes our issue with having the policies and the implementation of these policies, because I feel as though they could have had the foresight to know that persons would be trying to go and renew, and or at least already, because I remember when I tried to renew my license, it was the same thing. You got a date late down, and I believe they were saying we end up going to licensing in 0.14 or something like that, because that's where the opening was. So it isn't as though only because the fine increase you can't get a date that existed before. So you would have expected that you probably would have worked out the kinks, especially since persons would now be penalized for not having it done. And they are trying to get it done and not able to do so. So that's generally, I think, an issue in Trinidad that we have with, we have any policies or we putting forward these plans and not necessarily thinking through the implementation of it, you know?
So then what do you recommend or think that should be done for justice in Trinidad and Tobago as it relates to persons with these punitive measures being put in place? From a government standpoint and with your learned ability, what should have been practical for government before instituting or, you know, making it mandatory, these punitive measures?
At least letting persons know beforehand and giving like a period so that persons can get their house in order at the very least.
A period for what?
Because in this case, you're saying that a person would be penalized for having an expired license, as you may say, for an example, and you're trying to go on the system online to make an appointment, because you have to make an appointment to renew your license in any of the licensing offices.
And you can only do it within a 30-day period of the expiration date.
Yeah.
Leading up to the expiration date.
Yeah. And I mean, it isn't just a situation where somebody was driving without a license. Some persons probably wasn't just driving for that period of time. So that's why their license probably wasn't renewed within it. So I guess it was mentioned, they said, in the budget discussion. But I guess
it wasn't debated.
It wasn't, and it was not debated. But even beyond that, just a little consultation, a little notice letting persons know. You know, like sometimes they would say, by January the 1st, 2026, this is going to come into effect, you know? I mean, it kind of came like a thief in the night,
like a Section 34. My phones are buzzing. Good morning. We on Justice this morning. Hello.
A pleasant good morning, Devi. A pleasant good morning is Mandisa.
Andisa.
All right. I ain't Godfather, but all right.
Yeah.
Pleasant good morning and Happy New Year to you. I don't know if I talk to you for the year. Devi, I just want to have a brief comment on the financial tip, because both of you were engaged in the discussion. When I understand the point you were making, and you are right. However, when you're borrowing money, what you are actually doing is buying time. So sometimes it costs you, but it is convenient because you need the money at the same time. So the savings and whatever additional costs and so on is the price for the time that makes it convenient and that you can get your business done. So that is my addition to that. Davey, you will recall when Antonio was in the program, I had raised the issue with regard to those new type of motorbikes. You have two wheels, you have some three-wheel tricycles that is motored, and I understand you have a few four-wheel. They are not licensed on the road, and my suggestion and my recommendation is that there be some form of license for it. I raised it this morning because I want to get the comment of Andisa on this issue. Maybe I'm going to call the minister whether he will answer or not, but I am going to raise that issue because it can be very dangerous on the road. If someone of those persons bonks you, what is going to happen? Or if they are killed on the road, what is going to happen? I thank you. Enjoy.
All right. He did raise the issue when we had the car care segment on Wednesday. But I think we'll have to get somebody from the licensing division or shed some insight into the legislation as to what constitutes a road vehicle.
Yeah.
I think it's has to do with the CCs on the engine.
And things like that,
Things like that. Not a motorized scooter.
Even though we are seeing some of the motorized scooters on the road.
But there was one with a pedal. So if the motor gives out, you could pedal like a bike now. I'm seeing that too, so I don't know if that is the reason why. Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Justice.
Good morning. Yeah, welcome to thank Adisa for being here. Since Adisa has been here, and I know the legislation has not hit the parliament yet, but since Carney Central has opened the door to other things, I just want to touch on a couple of things here. Question: does an individual in Trinidad and Tobago have the right not to incriminate himself? Question two: if a policeman asks me my name, and I told him that my name was John Thomas, who was there to hear that? It's just between him and I. So therefore, I could get a year in prison for telling him that my name is John Thomas. The same thing with an address. And the other question I want to ask you is this. Is it possible that a country could run where the constitutional rights of me, who is living in a Zozo, and the constitutional rights of someone else who is living in a non-Zozo are different? Shouldn't we all be treated equally before the law? I listen to your comments.
That's some very good questions, boy.
Yeah.
And you are a constitutional expert, in my opinion. You are well versed in that.
Yeah, well, the first question, if someone doesn't have to incriminate himself, you don't. So that's why accused persons have the right to remain silent. A person could do an entire trial and say absolutely nothing. They don't have to go into the box to give evidence. Based on the situation, we would advise someone if they need to give evidence to put forward their case. So, for instance, if you're relying on self-defense, you would want to go into the box to explain what was happening at the point in time. Or if you're relying on provocation, you would want to go in the box and explain, well, this is the history between this person on this night. This person came with a cutlash towards me, etc., etc. But generally, a person have the right to remain silent, and you could go through your entire trial and say absolutely nothing. You can't incriminate yourself, essentially. These hotspot zone, I think, is such an interesting development, if you're being quite honest. But the Constitution does put things in place for the government to make decisions on behalf of the country. And if they go in Parliament and they get the requisite majority, to note is that this government has a special majority, to be quite honest. They have more than enough seats to put forward those things. Obviously, the fight would be in the upper house when, of course, we have the independent senators and the government senators who would also have to be on board to get the requisite majority. But the Constitution allows for this to happen. So when you're deciding who you want to vote for, those are things you have to consider, because this person now has the mandate to make decisions on your behalf. And if you give this person the mandate to make decisions on your behalf, and this is what they decide to do, and they have the majority in Parliament to get it done, I mean, we still want persons to voice their opinions, because I'm generally of the opinion, even though you need to vote here or there, you should still be able to criticize or give opinions to that same party, regardless of how strongly you support that party. I am not the person who believe that you should just continuously blindly support any political party. you could disagree because you disagree with persons within your family, even though you love them to death, and you continue on the next day. So you don't necessarily have to agree with every single thing that they do. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you have to recognize that if this is the government that you gave the mandate to make decisions on behalf of the country, and the constitution allows these persons to make decisions one day, once they receive the requisite majorities in the lower and the upper house,
then it's a done deal. But when it comes to constitutional rights, he talked about one community constitutional rights is being infringed upon while another has, you know, a sense of freedom. What are your thoughts?
So I want to see how exactly they intend to implement that particular thing.
They're mimicking Jamaica.
Yes. I'm under the impression that they would, in fact, mimic Jamaica, but it would essentially be that some, just like under the SOE where the rights are suspended, so it kind of a situation like that where some areas, it wouldn't be, I remember during the SOE, some places had a curfew, whereas some did not. So it kind of would be where they etch it out in a situation like that. So it wouldn't altogether be wrong. I want to see how exactly they intend to implement it, to see how exactly we could scrutinize it. So if, you know, obviously there are attorneys, they are vigilant, who would quite quickly, I'm certain,
deal with it. Because, if you impose a 72-hour curfew in a particular area, let's say Enterprise, and you single out a particular area in Enterprise, and you launch a 72-hour curfew on them, you have persons working, coming in later hours or even leaving very early hours to get to work. So if your curfew suspends or ends at 5, mm-hmm. in the morning, but starts at 8 at night. You have persons coming in from casinos, persons going to work. You have persons in different security agencies traveling from long distances. I myself, at some mornings, depending on the morning, I would have to leave home 35 minutes earlier. So like this morning was one where I had to leave. I started traveling, moving around out of the house on the roadway from about 4:27 this morning. All right, and then there are some mornings I would just leave at 5.
Yeah.
You know, so circumstances change. And if you suspend the rights of persons in communities, you are infringing on the constitutional right because they live in a community perceived to be a hot zone.
Yeah.
There's no fault of theirs. This is where they live.
Yeah. And just to add to the conversation, which is why I said I can't wait to see how exactly they intend to bring it forward, because even in Trinidad and Tobago, our constitution allows for special acts, which would expressly declare at the beginning that it infringes on certain rights of the individuals within it, but they're doing it because it is for the better good of the country, quite essentially. But even in that process, and even in process where they pass regular pieces of legislation, it isn't a situation where the parliament could just go pass legislation and that is it. The court could still review it and determine whether or not it balances against the good that they are trying to do, whether it is necessary. So there would still be that discussion as well. If you infringe the right, and I mean, our constitution allows for special acts, and our constitution allows for the suspension of rights under SOEs and things to that effect, but the court and society generally would still have to scrutinize it to figure out whether the measure they are implementing, i.e. these hotspot zones, would achieve the good that they are trying to
do,
which is the reduction of crime. So they would still have that balancing act that they would have to do. So I can't wait to see what the discussion would be in parliament. I can't wait to see how exactly they intend to implement it, because to be quite honest, I think it is an extreme measure.
It is, and it's one that, I think it's being rushed to get done. Good morning, caller. All right, call me back. 625-2257. Sorry about that, Andisa was winding up. 627-3223. Somebody say, oh gosh, boy, tell Andisa I said good morning. So, Andisa, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so message delivered, all right? Hello, good morning.
Morning. Good morning. I just find out one thing from your constitutional person there.
You're not coming across clear.
Your constitutional person on are your host this morning.
Andisa, like Andisa is the co-host on Fridays. Rudy, this is Rudy.
Is it? A couple days ago, we had a party from the police service who spoke about tribunals for corrections of officers, etc. My question to you is, what is the tribunal for the correction or professional misconduct of judges of the Supreme Court?
All right, thank you.
We have Judicial Legal Service Commission. So generally in Trinidad and Tobago, in the Commonwealth Caribbean, one of the tenants or one of the pillars that we try to uphold is the independence of the judges. So they want an independent, impartial body who would be in charge of firstly hiring these judges, firing if it comes to that. Generally, they go straight until retirement, and you shouldn't fire a judge for cause, because you don't necessarily want them to feel as though their job is at risk at any point in time, and also for the disciplining of them. So it's usually the Legal Service Commission who does that, who does everything in relation to judges. So it shouldn't be any external body, especially anybody who is in the political arena, that would have a say on disciplining these judges. And the reason for that is that you don't want them to feel as though if they are adjudicating over a decision that involves a politician or involves anything like that, or if they give an unfavorable decision, that they will then face some kind of disciplinary proceedings and their job would be at risk and things like that.
But why does that happen, though? Why if they make a decision that can be seen as extrajudicial, so to speak? Why they can't be reprimanded? If they handed down a judgment that has been appealed and their judgment overturned rather than being upheld?
No, well, I mean, if their judgment is overturned, that's just part of our legal proceedings. That's fine. We have the trial court. If you aren't satisfied with that decision and you want to challenge the decision of the court, and you could challenge the decision of the court based on the law, you said that they didn't apply the law correctly, or the facts, you said that they didn't apply the facts correctly, it's generally harder to overturn decisions of facts. But still, you go to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal could overturn that decision, and you could then appeal that and go to the Privy Council. So that's just part of our legal framework. Procedure, yeah.
Right.
I don't feel as though we should penalize a judge for giving a decision because of that, unless if it is wholly unacceptable, and then I guess they would have their own internal mechanisms to deal with that. But at the end of the day, what judges do, judges interpret the law. So sometimes you could have an interpretation of something and I have a different interpretation of it. That's just part of it.
So then how do we get justice if interpretation is subjected to persons who are, one, I mean, we're not perfect.
Yeah.
We are imperfect humans. And we have to subject ourselves to a judge who might interpret this thing differently and have me under a custodial sentence for many years when another judge may not have seen it that way or were interpreted different. Why are we subjecting ourselves to interpretation of law rather than the actual rule of law?
Right. No, well, you're putting forward several different tenets there. So the first thing is that we have separation of powers. Parliament makes law. The judiciary just applies the law. They can't just come into court and decide that I'm just going to interpret it in this particular way. Usually the attorneys of both sides would have to put forward legal arguments, and we are based on precedent. So we'd have to put forward cases. It could be cases from Trinidad and Tobago that was already decided that has the same facts. It could be cases from the Commonwealth Caribbean or internationally as well. Internationally, it would both mean persuasive. But you would have to show, well, hey, the courts have decided this case with this similar facts like this before. So you can't just come up one day and decide, I'm going to interpret the law in this particular way. It's usually based on sound legal arguments and precedents.
And precedents, but then how does precedents get established? Not because somebody did it once?
Yeah.
How do we start on... My thing is, right, Pratt & Morgan, using that for example.
Mm-hmm.
Pratt & Morgan was a precedent set, I think it was Jamaica?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that was a precedent set. Not before, that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But one person decided to set this precedent and do this. I'm saying, what if we set a new precedent?
Well, that could happen. So, no, let me not say that could happen just generally like that. What happens is, you just said that we have all the appeals. So usually for precedent, it's that it isn't just, when putting forward decisions or as precedent, we use the trial decisions sometimes as well, but you usually look for the Privy Council decisions or the decisions that have been appealed all the way or a Court of Appeal decision, because you see that it has been scrutinized. If you don't agree or if you don't accept that something was decided correctly, then you have the option to appeal to the Court of Appeal, then appeal to the Privy Council. And then after a while, after all the legal arguments, you decide that this is the position that we adopting. In the case of Pratt & Morgan, that is also... Why I say that is a different case, because as I mentioned before, when we discussed the death penalty, the Privy Council have decided it on one basis, which we have seen in Chandler, and then in the Caribbean Court of Justice, the judges in that court have decided that the savings clause decision in a completely different way. If you're being quiet, I don't think that persons really understand how interesting that development is, that we have the Privy Council who have said that you can't really necessarily go behind the savings, the piece of law, because it was safe law, and we have the CCJ saying something completely different as well. So sometimes we do see those things happen, but at the end of the day, we have a system in place where, firstly, you bring it forward. You don't have an attorney. You're not paying the attorney all this money for nothing. We have to go. We have to research it and look and see how the court decided it before, how other courts have decided it, how we think it should be decided, and put forward those arguments, make those arguments to court in writing, orally. The judge decides. If you don't accept that the judge was right, you can appeal, and then you're appealing. You have to set out your grounds of appeal in that appeal and say, hey, I don't agree with this decision because this is wrong, this is wrong. You have to set it out. Usually, once you're reaching the appeal court, you know you have to come real good. You have to ensure that your arguments are even sound. It can have a panel of 5 or 3 judges now scrutinizing everything that was put forward. If you don't agree with what the Court of Appeal say, you have the option to appeal again to the Privy Council. Now you have the law lords now deciding whether they accept the decision of the trial court or not. So we have now went through 3 different courts who have scrutinized the decision, and then a precedent will be set. So hopefully, our hope is that by the time we reach the Privy Council, that's why you usually look to those decisions first when you're putting forward arguments. You know that it has went through extreme scrutiny, and more than likely this is decision and a precedent has been set.
So basically, whatever the presiding judge decided upon or adjudicated on and make his pronouncement on, gavel went down.
Yeah.
This is the judgment. When you appeal and you go before the appellate judges and you present between 3 to 5 judges, your case, your appeals, your reason for wanting this judgment overturned must be airtight. You must now put it there where you did your research.
Yes.
This is why you are saying that this judgment is either harsh and unimpressive or whatever it is, it's unfair.
Yeah.
It should not have been.
And you have to set that out. You have to set out the reasons why you think it is wrong. So one of the first things you have to do is outline your grounds of appeal.
So the appellate judges now will go through the entire case after that.
Yeah.
So they will actually now start to look at everything that was presented between prosecution and
and the defense.
And defendants.
So it's a civil matter as well. You could appeal civil decisions.
So
as
between
well.
Plaintiff and defense, they go through it.
Claimants and defendants.
Or claimant, well, in general, we just say claimant.
Yeah, and one of the first things that you do is once you know you want to appeal, you have to request the transcript of the proceedings in the trial court, because you usually have to give the court that, and they will go through every single thing to determine if a mistake was actually made. So if it's a criminal matter,
what if a mistake wasn't made? However, find that the judgment was a bit harsh and oppressive.
So, that depends, right? So if it's a criminal matter, you could appeal firstly, for instance, the conviction, and you could say that you don't believe that you should have been found guilty, or you could appeal the sentence and say, okay, I was found guilty, but I feel as though the sentence that the trial judge gave me was a bit too harsh. And then you have to set out and say why I think that the sentence was too harsh, because I look at previous decisions and it have a case with similar facts, and this person received 10 years and I received 35 years in prison for the same thing. And you have to set that out. You request the transcript. You let the so that the court can see what exactly happened, and then the court decides. If you're appealing the conviction, for instance, and you're saying, "Well, I don't feel as though I should have been found guilty because I didn't receive a fair trial. The judge didn't do this. The judge didn't give this direction to the jury. The judge didn't give a proper direction to the jury." And what the appeal court could do at that point in time is say, "Well, okay, I agree," and send the matter back to for there to be a retrial. Or they could say, "I don't agree. I'm upholding that you, in fact, there was a fair trial." And
so if they agree that the judge's decision was a bit punitive, do they have to do a retrial in order to, or can they pass a judgment that supersedes or vetoes the one of the sitting magistrates?
Trial in those instances. If you're saying that you didn't receive a fair trial. So the appellate courts, they usually don't preside over issues of facts. to be quite honest,
they will just,
you would have to show why you think that the trial judge didn't.
But if you were successful at that point, is the question. If you were successful at getting the appellate judges to understand and agree, and Lisa, attorney at law, you were correct. I think we did have some errors here. I think this could have been dealt differently.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that, let's say you're saying, okay, the person was guilty, but this is what happened, and they should not have received a 35-year sentence when somebody has got 10 and precedents were set, maybe 12 might have been acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Would they then adjust the sentencing?
Yeah, so they have done it before, and they would say, well, they think they will go through it, and they usually appeal. If you read, read the appeal decisions, see how they, because you could see how they reason, you see how they come to their conclusion, and they set it out. So what they usually do, they outline the facts, they usually give a summary of the facts, and they usually give a summary of the law, and they go through it, and they say, well, in this case, this happened, in that case, that happened, in this case, the range is usually this. You see how we have really amazing appellate court judges here. So it depends. I said it depends because it depends on what you appealed for.
Right,
if you're appealing and you're saying, well, I didn't receive a fair trial, I'm just going to just decide that this is what should happen. You're now not guilty. More than likely, they would order a retrial. But if you're saying that is the sentence, they can lessen it. Yeah, they would, lessen it based on what is put forward. If they think that based on the previous decisions and based on the facts of the case or whatever, and this is the better thing, they'll say that.
And if they say that, they
could even order that the send it back for
sentencing, for resentencing.
Yeah, they have that option.
Oh, so they could order resentencing by the sitting magistrate the presiding judge on that matter.
Mm-hmm.
They can send it back, and the judge will then have to revisit when that goes back to the judge. Does he have to revisit everything now and then say, okay, he agrees? What if he can't disagree at that point? He have to resentence.
Yeah, well, yeah. And now, hopefully, you have now have the benefit of the decision of the Court of Appeal, and you go through the system, you go through the process again, you hear submissions from prosecutor, you hear submissions from the defense, and you decide what was the sentence that this person should have.
Right. And in the absence of that, and it goes to the Privy Council, because the appellate judges...
Because the Court of Appeal could come and say, well, I'm dismissing this appeal.
Yeah.
And you could appeal to the Privy Council, then obviously there's a process. You can't just go once only, and you don't really have grounds. You have to apply for leave. Most time you have to set out why you want to appeal the decision and all of that. And if it goes and they decide. So even Vibes Cartel's case, for instance, he was found guilty by the trial judge. He appealed. His appeal was overturned, and he appealed to the Privy Council, and
that's
agreed.
He got freed.
Yeah,
because he went there, but that's a very costly and time
very,
consuming.
Very costly.
All right.
Process.
I think we got some information there.
Brother Davey, good morning to you and your guests in the studio.
She's
I have a
co-host.
Question. My driver's permits are going to be expiring on the 13th of April, 2026 this year. According to what they say, you go online 1 month before, and you do your application in such a manner. So my question is now, if I do that 1 month prior to the expiration date of my permit, and I do get a date down the road, let's just say 2-3 months from then, am I supposed to print out that and keep in my possession until that date comes for me to go and renew my permit? Or are you saying that if I go to the license office when I print it out, I will be charged a higher fee for an expired driver's permit? Please reply, thanks.
That is such an interesting thing, and I think that one of the ministers should decide at this point.
We already know the answer to that.
Yeah.
I will tell you, yes, you are subjected to pay the late fees.
Yeah.
And as Andisa said, the minister, they need to revisit, because Andisa said it on the onset of justice this morning that they ruled out this template of punitive measures without proper infrastructure to deal with the influx of motorists now trying to align themselves with the proper, the correct thing. So what we saw the Prime Minister dug up was how lawless we are, and not, I'm not going to use the word lawless, but how lackadaisical and complacent we are. Because here is something that people don't know. Do you know insurance companies send you notification that your insurance is about to expire? They send you via a text, they call you, and they also send it out in TT Post, in the mail. I have received with a correspondence reminding me within the next 6 weeks, your insurance will be expired. Within a month, you have to renew. I have gotten those reminders from insurance companies for motor vehicle. So even if I forget, I got that notice three ways. A text came to my phone. I got a phone call from the insurance company. And I also received correspondence in the mail reminding me. So I ignore all those three things. Let's say I missed the phone call. I didn't get the phone call. I missed it. They probably call back. I didn't answer because I don't know this number. Them dotishness people just do. You just do that too? Don't answer your phone because you don't know your number? Really? Can't do that. You're a business person. What if your brothers?
Yeah.
And they fall along somewhere and they just give me a call. I'm call my or the police. Or just call my sister for me now, please. And this person say, all right, let me call. What's the number? The number is just calling me. And your face skin up. So I'm not saying that. And you're only to find out after your family is in distress. I don't ever if you answer the phone call and it's somebody that on the other end that you do not wish to speak, what do you have the power to do?
Yeah, you can handle it if you want to.
Listen, so the insurance company reminds you. So Larry, to answer your question, and Disa was correct. Boy, the infrastructure is not proper right now. So if you overstay your permit, you will be penalized for it. No matter what system they give you. Good morning. Hello? All right, good morning.
Good morning. My question really was in terms of the sanctioning of judges for failure to uphold the Constitution and the law. This is not, it may seem as if this is something very strange, but actually it's not. So Section 137 of the Constitution speaks directly to professional misconduct of judges and how it's dealt with. My question to you is, how do you go about the process? So you mentioned the Judicial and Legal Services Commission. How do we get to that body to investigate matters? And how are we assured of an outcome? Can I listen?
Of course.
Yeah, to be quite honest, I'm not certain how they initiate the process. I'm certain that within the judiciary, because the judiciary will usually take charge of that. You go report the decision. But what I'm saying is, if you feel as though a judge hasn't upheld the Constitution, or you feel as though their decisions, based on what you're saying, I could be wrong. It seems as though the issue surrounds the decision that the judge has made. And what I'm saying is, there's a process to appeal if you think that the decision that the judge made isn't correct. And if you feel as though, one decision that a judge made that you don't necessarily agree with, I don't think that that's essentially misconduct. Unless if you're saying that they acted, they received a bribe from somebody to rule in this particular way, then I think that that will be classified into the category of misconduct. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you have to actually understand what is the complaint against this judge in the first place. If you feel as though their decision isn't correct, then we have the process of appeal. If you feel as though they have misconducted themselves, that has a very specific definition.
Mm-hmm.
This judge was influenced by a politician to rule in this particular way, or this judge was influenced to get rid of this case, or something like that. They received a bribe, and you have actual evidence to show that the judge received this bribe, then I think that that will fall within the category of misconduct. We can't be too quick to say that because a judge didn't give a decision that you probably don't agree with,
mm-hmm.
that will fall within the category of misconduct. If they do, then I guess that you report it to the judiciary, and they will, in their internal process, will kick off. Because as I indicated, generally, external persons shouldn't have like a hand in disciplining judges. It will be
the judiciary themselves.
Yes, the Judicial Legal Service Commission to deal with that.
The CJ should play a part in such once it's reported.
So obviously the CJ is the head of the judiciary.
Is the head, right.
So he will determine how that is done, and he will determine if to direct it to the Service Commission, etc.
Hello, good morning. Hello? All right. Hello, good morning.
Hello, morning, Davey.
Yeah, quickly, please.
If ever you cannot get an appointment within the month, if ever you happen to get an appointment after the month, you will still pay the fine if your DP of the officer will tell you could have gone and walk in like Caroni or Port of Spain. I'm not sure for Arima. So
yeah,
although you get a late after your appointment, when you book it online, although you have that appointment, you could still go to a walk-in like Caroni or Port of Spain.
All right, thank you for that. And I agree. I did a walk-in on my own last year, November. I actually did a walk-in. I wasn't aware that you had to do it online until after I got through and I left. I went to Sandy Grande.
Yeah, Sandy Grande.
Listen,
yeah.
Man, within 15 minutes, I received my license.
But the thing about that is, like, even when you're renewing your passport, you could usually go to the branch in Sandy Grande. But they usually only take the first 10 persons, and after that, no, come back the next day.
Well, I went there 2 o'clock in the day.
Yes, well.
And I got you.
Oh. Well, I remember when I was trying to renew my passport and I needed it urgently and I was only getting a date some next year.
Yeah, that's when Grandy.
I went, but they had to be really, and I was number 10. And the person after me, they were like, well, we're not taking anybody else. But what I'm saying is that's very difficult to allow that no person have to try to get you to renew. It's not as though they're not willing to renew the license. They are. They are trying to. They aren't successful, and they might still be penalized.
No, I want persons to understand something. I know you have to go after this because you have court, and I want to thank you very much for keeping your... I mean, justice, we have new things, or you're going to see the new... artwork. The new artwork is coming within this month, before
new
the end
guests.
Of this month. New guests will be on the show for Justice, and new promos and intros, all those things are coming within the first quarter of Justice that is going to be rolled out here on Freedom. Some insurance companies give you a discount if you sign up for automatic renewal using your credit card info. And these are in the case where driver's permit renewal or license renewal can be won in the civil court. The case with the driver's renewal, can it be won in civil court? They cannot charge you for late penalties if their system is at fault. Precedent was set. A lawyer won a case like that already. Is that fact? Well, we can't really go into it much again. We are on the nose of the time right now for the news coming up at 8 o'clock. But I will tell you, Davey, somebody asked me if I paid any late fees. No, I did not. But you have to remember, the Prime Minister rolled out these new fees and initiatives this year, January 1. So anything last year was null and void. And I was expired. I went a bit late to get mine renewed. But the thing is, that was from January 1 this year is when this initiative and these late fees were tabled. So it had nothing to do with last year. Andy, sir, thank you so much for today. It has been a pleasure being with you again for Justice. Look out for another fantastic edition of this show next Friday at 7:20.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.